We live in an age of gurus. There are business gurus, financial gurus, weight loss gurus, relationship gurus, the list goes on and on. One of the top new movies in theaters today is called The Love Guru. You know, these folks hold seminars, they appear on television, they write books, and they make an awful lot of money along the way. Now these days we use the word guru to describe an expert in a particular field. Over in India and Indonesia, where this word is very popular, the term is widely used just in the general meaning of a teacher. And that's what pupils will address their teacher as. But I was interested to see how the word was originated. The word guru comes from two words in the old Sanskrit language. Gu means darkness, ru means light. A guru was one who could see the difference between light and darkness and teach that to others. That's originally where that term came from. And with his penchant for using the images of light and darkness, I'll bet the Apostle John would have used this word if he had known about it. Because he's constantly referring to the light as opposed to the darkness, Jesus being the light of the world. You know, not only did Jesus show us the light, he was the light. So I would say that in the true definition of the word, Jesus was the greatest guru who ever lived. He was indeed the master. He was the teacher. He embodied wisdom and knowledge. And as we come to the 13th chapter of John's Gospel, the subject matter at hand is greatness. Now, you might not see that as you just look at the text, but as you consider the entire background of the event that was taking place, you'll see here that we have the title of my message this morning, Guidance from the Greatness Guru. The disciples were all about greatness. They wanted to know who was the greatest, and Jesus was going to show them, not just tell them, but show them the path to greatness. Now, as he typically does, John opens this chapter by setting the stage. And as you look at verses 1 and 2, you see a swirling storm that was brewing. John writes, "It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus." Here you see several elements all crashing together as this scene unfolds. John notes that it was just before the Passover feast. And some scholars have debated as to the sequence of events that happen leading up to the crucifixion of Jesus. But most likely, what we're reading about here in John 13 took place on Thursday of what has become known as Passion Week. This is the night before Jesus was to be crucified on Good Friday. All right, so we're talking about just a number of hours that Jesus had left. Now, while the scholars might be unsure of the timing, verse 1 records that Jesus knew that his hour had come. There was no doubt in his mind. He knew that the time had come for him to offer the sacrifice of his very life. Now, if you go through the Gospel of John as we've done, you'll note that John emphasizes the fact that Jesus really lived according to a heavenly timetable. Note the development of this theme through the Gospel. In John 2:4, Jesus said, "My time has not yet come." In John 7:30, John writes, "His time had not yet come." Likewise, in John 8:20, "His time had not yet come." This is a recurring theme throughout the gospel. The time was not now. The time was not right. There is a sense of divine timing that is crucial to the whole gospel. Now in John 12:23, Jesus says, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." Our text today, John 13:1, Jesus knew that the time had come. And then in a few chapters from now, we will read in John 17:1, Jesus is praying and he says, "Father, the time has come." So up until this point, we've been looking ahead. The time isn't yet. The time isn't yet. It's almost like driving on a long trip with kids and they're saying, "Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet?" And the answer is no, 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 no. And then all of a sudden, yeah, we're here. We've got to that place in the Gospel of John. The time has come. Jesus' hour has come. And what this says to us is that nothing ever happened to Jesus that took him by surprise. He knew why he had come. He knew what he had to do, and he knew when it would happen. And all of these events are coming together. You have the plot of against Jesus that was now rolling. We've already read previously in John that the Sanhedrin had met. The Sadducees and the Pharisees came together. They set aside their differences and they said, "We have got to do something about Jesus." And they all agreed that what they needed to do was to eliminate him. So they had decided, "We've got to get rid of this Jesus." What they needed was an inside man. Somebody who could lead them to Jesus at the right time. Because Jesus was very popular. And they didn't want to just snatch him out of the crowds because they thought the crowds would turn on him. So they needed somebody on the inside who could get to Jesus when the crowds weren't around. And they found their man in Judas Iscariot. Judas went to the high priest and said, I will turn Jesus over to you so that you can arrest him away from the crowds. And they paid him for that betrayal. And John records that here in these opening verses. Another element that added to this surrounding storm isn't recorded here, but it's found in the other Gospels. If you read in Luke chapter 22, which is recording the same night, the night in which Jesus was betrayed, the night before he would be crucified, we are told that when the disciples gathered in the upper room, verse 24 says, a dispute arose among them as to which of them was considered to be the greatest. Here Jesus has gathered his disciples in preparation for the Passover. He knew what was coming. They didn't. He knew that his time was very short. But they all get together, and what are the disciples worried about? Who's the greatest? Who is the greatest? They all sound like Muhammad Ali. I am the greatest. Right? And if you go through the Gospels, you find that this happened more than once. They're arguing about who's better than who. You know, James and John at one point tried to use their mother, who very well may have been Jesus' aunt, physically speaking, tried to use old mom to get their place above the other apostles. You see this happen over and over again. Can you imagine how Jesus must have felt? Here he has invested 3 years with these 12 men. He has poured out his life into them. He has taught them. He has shown them through his actions. All of this, and he knows that his time with them on earth is coming to a close. It's final exam time, and he looks out, and they're flunking. They didn't get it. And I'm sure that must have weighed heavy on his heart. Luke goes on to record Jesus' response to the 12. Jesus said to them, "The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, And those who exercise authority call themselves benefactors. But you are not to be like that. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest, the one who rules like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who is at the table? But I am among you as one who serves. Or in the words of the song we heard during communion time, I've come to serve you. Elsewhere, Jesus had said in the Gospel of Mark, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. So again, this was an ongoing lesson he was trying to impress upon these guys. Now, as powerful as these words are, John records in our text this morning how Jesus demonstrated this truth by what he did. What follows is an acted out parable. It's like ones we find many times in the Old Testament prophets, in which Jesus takes his teaching and now he acts it out. He gives them a visual image. This is what servanthood looks like. And that's what we read about back in John chapter 13. Picking up the narrative in verse 3, Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. I want to stop there for just a moment. What do those words tell you about Jesus? Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power. He came from God. He was returning to God. These words drip with authority. They drip with power. Jesus Christ had all authority on heaven and earth, and he knew it. Jesus Christ was God in the flesh, and he knew it. Most of us would think that with all of that authority and with all of that power, Jesus would exercise that power. What follows is a tremendous irony. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. Now, this scene might seem a little strange to us, but it was very familiar in the ancient world. Back in those days, they didn't have cars. They didn't have bikes. Some would travel by horses. Some of the really rich might have chariots. But most people walked. And where they walked weren't the paved roads that we see today. They were mostly dirt roads, and they were dusty. That was a very dry climate over there, so you had a lot of dust. And when people would come to your home, their feet would be dusty. If it had rained, they might even be muddy. Why? Because people wore open sandals. So you had a lot of dust or dirt that gathered on the feet. Now, in that culture, even to this day, when you go to the door of the home, you take off your shoes. It's a sign of respect. And it's just courteous. I mean, why drag all that stuff in when you've been walking through the dust? So what would happen in those days is that the guests would be greeted at the door, they would remove their shoes, and a slave would wash the feet of the guests so that they went into the house with clean feet. That job was generally reserved for the bottom slave on the totem pole. In my workplace, everything operates by seniority. The people who have been there the longest get the first pick of the jobs. They decide whether or not they were going to work overtime and all that stuff. People at the bottom of the list, they don't even get asked. They get told. That's what this job was reserved for. Nobody asked a servant, do you want to wash the feet of the guests? He just said, you do it. And Jesus is the one who takes this job. You see, there was no slave on this occasion. Jesus had asked for a private room. So it was just him and the disciples. And none of the disciples bothered to wash even their own feet, let alone anybody else's. Chuck Swindoll notes, what's interesting is that none of the disciples had volunteered for that lowly task, so the room was filled with proud hearts and dirty feet. Interestingly, those disciples were willing to fight for a throne, but not for a towel. Things haven't changed a lot since then, by the way. And that's true. So what happens? Jesus takes this opportunity to drive home the lesson he had just told him. Think about the words of Luke. Think about what Luke records Jesus told the disciples. Here they're bickering about who's the greatest, and he says, no, no, no. You want greatness? You need to be a servant. And now he illustrates that point. He took off his outer tunic. He wrapped a towel around his waist. He starts washing the disciples' feet. And if that shocks you, imagine what it must have done to those disciples. Probably blew their minds. I like how Max Lucado puts it. We want to say, why are you washing their feet? You know what they've done. What's more, you know what they're about to do. You can already hear them snoring in the garden. They say they'll stay awake, but they won't. You'll sweat blood, they'll saw logs. You can hear them sneaking away from the soldiers. They make promises tonight. Tomorrow they'll make tracks. Look around the table, Jesus. Out of the 12, how many will stand with you in Pilate's court? How many will share with you the Roman whip? And when you fall under the weight of the cross, which disciple will be close enough to spring to your side and carry your burden? None of them will. Not one. A stranger will be called because no disciple will be near. Don't wash their feet, Jesus. Tell them to wash yours. I mean, that's the human reaction. When we see this unfold, that's what most of us would think. But Jesus was driving home a point. The disciples were after greatness, and he was about to show it to them. You say, how is doing this lowly task a sign of greatness? Because his demonstration of servanthood was a sign of meekness. You say, well, that doesn't sound all that great. Meekness, though, is not weakness. It's power under control. That's why those words at the beginning of verse 3 are so significant. Yeah, John just wasn't adding filler. Jesus knew that he had all authority of heaven and earth. He had the power of God the Son in the flesh. But what does he do? He chooses to do the lowliest act possible. You see, when you've got the power and you exercise it, there's nothing extraordinary about that. When you're forced to do something lowly, there isn't anything noteworthy about that. But when you have the power to make somebody else do something, but you do it yourself, that says something. When you have the authority to have somebody else do your dirty work for you, but you do it yourself, people are going to stand up and take notice. And I have an example of this right at my own workplace. I may have used this example before, but it just fits so perfectly here. We have a number of supervisors at our plant. You can usually tell who the supervisors are because they have their own uniform. They have a light blue shirt and dark blue pants. And they're usually quite clean. But we have one supervisor who wears a white uniform just like all the other workers. And he's not afraid to jump in if there's a problem and help clean up a mess or help get things going again. And usually his white uniform isn't very white by the end of the shift. Now, he could stand back and say, hey, you, get over here and do this. You, shovel that ice cream that spilled. You, take the garbage out. He has the authority and the power to do that, but he doesn't. Instead, he just jumps in and does it himself. Now, does he have any more or less authority than the other supervisors at the job? No. But I can guarantee you he has more respect. The workers at that plant will do a whole lot more for him than they will for anybody else. Why? Because he doesn't exercise his authority and tell other people what to do that he isn't willing to do himself. That's servanthood. That's meekness. Now, is there anything weak about that? No. That's an exercise of strength. That's an exercise of character. And that's precisely what Jesus was doing and making his point that that's where true greatness lies. It's when you have the authority and you have the power, but you don't abuse it. You use it for the benefit of others. That is true greatness. And Jesus was himself the embodiment of service. As I mentioned earlier, in Mark, it's recorded that he says, I have not come to be served. Now, he had every right to demand that. He had every right to say, you people are going to serve me. But he didn't. He chose to serve others. And as you would see in the hours that followed this, the cross was the ultimate act of servanthood and surrender. Because Jesus didn't have to do that. Even while he was on the cross, as he said to Peter during his arrest, don't you know that I could call 10,000 angels to come rescue me? He had that authority, but he did not exercise it. That strength. I've been told that when soldiers train to become Navy SEALs, they grow through some of the most rigorous physical and emotional hardship possible before they can achieve that rank. But what's told is that the hardest part of all, the most difficult hurdle to cross, is that at any moment they can say, I want out, and they're out. And they don't lose rank. It doesn't go negatively on their record. They have a free pass out at any time. And that's the hardest obstacle of all. They have the authority to say, that's it. I don't want to go through this anymore. And they're out. But the military figures, if they can go through all of that, knowing they could get out and willingly persevere, that's going to make the kind of strong soldier they want for a Navy SEAL. Jesus at any moment could have said, that's it. I'm not doing this anymore. And he would have been released. He did not. That is true strength. That's true greatness. But he shows it through servanthood. You say, yeah, but I can't relate to the cross, you know. Jesus doesn't call me to die for somebody else's sin. No, he doesn't. And that's why this image is so relevant to us today. It's not just the ultimate sacrifice that we are called to give. We are called to sacrifice in smaller ways along the way. And washing feet is the kind of thing that can be done. It's not pleasant, it's not popular, but it is necessary. Now, as Jesus is washing the disciples' feet, I'm sure he did it in stunned silence until he gets to Peter. We can always count on Peter to break any moment of silence. Peter would have been a great disc jockey because there would never have been any dead air time. If it's silent for 2 seconds, Peter's got to say something. So Jesus comes to Peter, and Peter says, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? Is that a dumb question or what? You know, here's Jesus, he's got a towel, you know, the water basin. He's probably already washed some of them. And are you going to wash my feet? No, Peter, I'm going to do whatever. Jesus says, you don't understand it now, but you will later. And then Peter says, no, you will never wash my feet. Now he lays it down. You're not going to wash my feet. Now we look at that and we say, wow, that's pretty noble of Peter, you know. Lord, this is too lowly for you. No, you don't wash my feet. But there's something more to it than that. Something we may not initially recognize. He was unwilling to receive what Jesus was giving. And being willing to receive something sometimes takes more grace than it takes to give. And our reluctance to receive really exposes our pride, doesn't it? And that happens today. That happens among a lot of Christians. What's the typical reaction when we're given something? Oh, you shouldn't have. Oh, you didn't need to do that. You know what we're really saying? I don't need your help. What, don't you think I could do it on my own? That's pride. And even if we don't say it, often that's what's underlying our objections. Nothing less than ugly old pride. Whether it's grace from Christ or graciousness from others, we must humble ourselves in order to receive it. And it is a humbling thing to receive from others. But it's necessary. Jesus tells Peter, unless I wash you, you have no part with me. That word part really means participation. You have no participation with me. There's no fellowship. Now Peter goes to the other extreme. He says, well, if that's the case, give me a whole bath. Wash me head to toe. And again, we're tempted to think, well, isn't this noble of Peter? But not really. His answer is still the product of self-will. Peter's reluctant to let Jesus do what he wants. He prefers to dictate the terms. He's still telling Jesus what to do. And again, it exposes pride, and we need to be careful we don't make the same mistake as Peter. Let Jesus do what he will. And at those times when other people are acting in grace and are serving you, be humble enough to receive it. Because it really does take humility to be on the receiving end. The second lesson that comes from Jesus' reply to Peter, a person who's had a bath needs only to wash his feet. His whole body is clean. Now, to understand this, we got to understand a little bit about the culture of that day. And I'd like to draw from one of my favorite Greek scholars, Kenneth Wiest. He says there are two Greek words translated wash that appears in this passage. One means to wash part of the body, which appears in verses 5, 6, 9, and 10. The second word means to take a whole bath. And both of those words are used in what Jesus has to say. The first remains the same for time and eternity. The second changes from time to time during this life. Someone has once said, union with Jesus is so strong that nothing can break it. But communion with Jesus is so fragile that the slightest sin can break it. Now again, to consider the culture of the time, in those days during the Roman Empire, you had the baths, the Roman baths. You didn't have a bathtub or a shower in your own home. They had public baths. And so you would go there, and that's where you would take a bath. Now, when you came back home, you're walking on those dusty streets, so when you get home, your feet are dusty. But you don't have to take a whole bath again. All you have to do is rinse off your feet. That's a very powerful image for a spiritual truth. Because you see, when we come to Christ, when we initially come to Jesus and commit ourselves to Him and ask Him to forgive us our sins, He forgives all of our sin, past, present, and future. You say, I can't comprehend that. Understand that God is not bound by time. God is eternal. He sees the whole thing. It all happens at once to Him. So when He forgives, His forgiveness is total. Our sins have been forgiven, even the ones we haven't committed yet. But what happens? Even as Christians, from time to time, we stumble in sin. Probably on a daily basis, if we're honest. That does not break our union with Christ. We don't have to get saved all over again every time we sin. But what has to happen is we need our communion restored. Think about it in the case of a child with a parent. Child has done something wrong. They know they've done something wrong. They're pretty sure that their parent knows that they've done something wrong. Who is the last person on earth that child wants to see? The parent. And if it's possible, they'll hide as long as possible to keep from seeing that parent. Why? Because they're thinking that mom or dad's not very happy with me. Now, did they cease to be that parent's child? No. But the communion has been broken. The fellowship is lost. And that is what is restored when we confess our sin. John says in 1 John 1:9, if we confess our sin, He's faithful and just to forgive us our sin and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. He wrote that to Christians. It's not that we have to get the whole bath, but sometimes we need our feet washed. Now, where I think this really comes into play, I've known of some Christians. They live in fear. They're afraid that if they die with some sin in their life unconfessed, they're not going to go to heaven. If something happens and they die before they pray at night, Lord, forgive me of my sins, that somehow that's going to keep them out of heaven for all eternity. That's not true. Because the blood of Christ has forgiven us all of our sin. What is broken is not our relationship to God, it's our fellowship. And that can be restored on a more daily basis. So there's a tremendous lesson that we can learn here. Listen closely to what other texts say on the subject. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 6:11, you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. You notice the tense of those verbs? You were washed, you were justified. Past tense. It's something that's already been done. Hebrews 10:14. By one sacrifice, Jesus has made perfect forever those who are being made holy. This is just excellent for this idea. By one sacrifice, once and for all, Jesus made us perfect in the eyes of God. In the eyes of God the Father, we are righteous because we have the righteousness of Christ. But in our lives, we are being made holy. That's an ongoing process. So before God, we are clean. But in our day-to-day lives, we need that refreshing. We need that cleansing to keep our fellowship. Very briefly, Jesus moved from this symbolic submission to the disciples' subsequent service in verses 12 through 17. A passage was read earlier. Jesus sits down at the table after washing their feet and He says, do you understand what I just did? Probably not. So He goes on to explain. I am your teacher. You call me Master and Lord, and you should. Now, if I washed your feet, notice He doesn't say you ought to wash my feet. He says wash one another's feet. He's giving us an example for us to follow. In fact, He even uses those words. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. What that tells us is that we don't literally need to wash each other's feet. I've known some churches that have a foot washing ceremony. And that's okay for symbolism. But that's not what Jesus is talking about here. What Jesus is saying is you need to serve one another in whatever way that might be. Maybe for you, the lowliest thing you can imagine is cleaning a toilet. You know, that's just like the job that is the most lowly, disgusting thing you can think of. But if God has given you an opportunity to do that for somebody else or to do that for the church, that's a way to serve. Or whatever it might be that you think, I would never do that in a million years, don't be surprised if you're not called to do just that. Because that is the path to greatness. It's not doing what we want. It's not doing what we have to. It's doing what we may not necessarily want to do, but we know it's the right thing to do, and it's going to benefit somebody else. That is the path to greatness. That is what it means to follow Christ, to follow His example. As one author put it, we are never more like our Lord Jesus than when we serve God by become willing servants of others with no limits set. When we start telling God, I'll do anything but this, we're setting limits. Jesus never did that. Do you want to be great for God? Are you looking for some seminar or a how-to book written by a greatness guru? We don't need any of that because Jesus is our teacher. And He has shown us the light from the darkness. And He has given us guidance on the subject of greatness. Be a servant. Humble yourselves and serve one another. Meet the needs of others. Are we willing to do that? Only then can we truly be great for God.